Good morning, everybody. Today's life-driven topic, Man and the Evolution, presented by Mr. Gary Jacobs, sir, and Mr. Chandrasekhar, sir. And welcome, Mr. Gary Jacobs, sir, to continue this topic.
I'd like to wish everyone a very, very happy, wonderful new year. This year is going to be very special for our group because if we go according to schedule, we should finish our round of Life Divine lectures, first round, this year. We are on the 51st chapter, I think it is. We have we have five more after this, and we have 11 months to do it. They're longer chapters, very important chapters, but let's see. We can plan to complete the cycle this year, first cycle. Today's chapter is Man and Evolution. In one sense, he doesn't really say anything new in this chapter, but he reviews all that he has said and really gives the message very strongly of what we're here for. Why we're alive. Why our souls have gone through this long, long process of taking birth and rebirth over and over again for how many thousands of times? He doesn't give the number, but he says we started as matter. We started as the vegetables. Each of us. Not just our ancestors. Each of us has evolved and our soul has been evolving from the most material to the lowest vital and animal to the human level for a purpose. And in fact, the whole creation, the whole universe has been created for a purpose, for an evolutionary purpose. The question is, what is that purpose? And where do we go from here? We have made it this far. But why are we here? What have we come for? Where are we going? The idea that of evolution is not a new idea. But it's not an idea that is universally accepted even today. You may be aware that there's a battle going on between the scientists and the church in America among the more fundamentalist Christians, what the people who call themselves the creationists, who even today think that the idea of evolution is only a scientific theory that hasn't been proven. And we have not evolved from the animal at all. And this is an idea that can be found in different religions. Even some of the Indian scriptures would support this idea that there is in fact a divine being or divine consciousness or creative force that has created the universe, and it has created many different species. It has created the plant life, it's created the animal life, and now it's created the human life. But that doesn't mean that we have actually come from the animal, or the animal has come from the plant, or the plant has evolved from matter. There are some theories of creation that say humanity is not the last species to evolve, but we're the first. Even in the Indian tradition, there are some scriptures who talk about the human as the first. But all agree on one thing, and that is that the human is the highest rung on the ladder so far. The question is, what's next? Is this the end of the story? In Vedanta, the idea of evolution is very ancient. That out of the, there's an old proverb, I don't know whether it comes from Vedanta or Buddhism, in fact it's ascribed to many different things. They say, God sleeps in the mineral, dreams in the vegetable, in the plants, awakens in the animal, thinks in the human. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the mineral has become the vegetable, has become the animal, has become the human. Well, we may not think it really matters, but for him it matters very much. Main scientific theory is that man has evolved from the animal, but in fact, there's no proof. We have never seen one species turn into another species. We have seen yellow flowers become red flowers. We can make certain types of rice become fast-growing, high-yielding rice or drought-resistant rice. We can change things within a species. Even at the human level, we know how blue eyes and black hair and different colors come about, and why some people are taller and shorter, and even today's science is working on ways to improve the human species so we can live longer, so we can avoid certain diseases, genetic diseases, and so forth. But there's really no proof that any species, including the human, can evolve. There's no proof, scientific proof, that we've actually evolved from the ape. But that is the main predominant theory today. And in fact, Sri Aurobindo says that's true. But he says something else. He says, the scientists, all the religions assume that man is the last step. We may not be very perfect, we may not be very divine, but this is as far as the evolution goes, and beyond this, we have a couple of choices. One is, if we're really just materialists and atheists, we think we better enjoy this life while we have it, because after this it's all over. If we are Christians, we believe that after this life, we go to heaven, hopefully, and enjoy the benefits for eternity for something we have done during this brief lifetime. In Vedanta, we believe that the soul has gone through so many births to reach the human level, but now the option for us, the choice for us, the opportunity for us is to find the exit. Enough of this rebirth, enough of this going up and up and up and on the wheel of karma and suffering and all. Now the idea is to get to the exit. The exit is the shortcut to moksha. The evolution ends here, and the rest is we have to go back to the origin. We have to go back to the Brahman. And we have read in the earlier chapters where he says that is not the meaning of the evolution, that is not the fundamental purpose of the universe at all, that the divine has something else in mind, that the human is the staging ground and transition ground for something greater. And he says there's no reason to believe that if we have come this far from the mineral to the plant, from the plant to the animal, and the animal to the human, there's no reason to believe that we can't do better than this, that we can't go further. In fact, he says that evolution is a double movement. Science has studied evolution of the form, of the biological form. So we study the small single-celled plant becoming the bigger plants and the many different types of plants and eventually the trees, which are the biggest beings on Earth. The largest species on Earth are the huge redwood trees and those type that live for 2,000 years. And we have from the animal vegetable somehow come to be animal, tiny animals, bacteria and so forth, and now all the way up to this level. But this is really only the external part of evolution. This is the evolution of the forms. But Sri Aurobindo says it's a double movement, because along with the evolution of forms, there has been an evolution of consciousness. We do not have the consciousness of the stone and the sand, which as far as we know anyway, has no consciousness, at least nothing, it can't communicate anything to us. From the stone and the sand has come the plant life. And the plant definitely shows us some capacity of consciousness, some sensation. You know, okay. When the sun moves, the plants turn to move towards the sun. That can be seen even in the course of a day. The leaves change their direction like solar panels to capture more of the sun as it moves across the sky. Go towards the water, and wherever they find the water, they extend themselves in that direction. That means there is something conscious in the plant. It's not just a physical form. We know, especially in the higher animals, there's a much greater consciousness, greater awareness. If you call a dog, it knows its name. Those who have pets know. If you say it's time for dinner, the dog starts barking. Or if you say, do you want to go outside, he runs to the door. That means there is a consciousness in the dog. And in other animals, it's there. And there are animals that can use tools to solve problems, to dig holes, to open a nut, to do things like that. There are many. There are the squirrels who bury the food because they know winter is coming and it won't be available, so they store it up and they remember where it is and go back and get it. So there are many, many varieties of indication that animals have a higher consciousness than the plant, as the plant does from the mineral. And of course we come to the human level, where we know the human has a consciousness far different than that of other animals. It's not just that we can develop technology and build computers. We are among the few animals that have a language. I don't think we have hundreds, thousands of languages. There are a few thousand languages. But we also have something that no other species has, as far as we know, and that is we are not just conscious of other things. We are not just conscious of objects and other people or forms around us. We're conscious of ourselves. We have self-awareness. The dog may know its name. It's learned, but the dog probably doesn't wake up in the morning and wonder, I wonder what's the purpose of my life and what was I in my last life and where will I be in my future life and why am I a dog and not a human or a cat. As far as we know, no other animal reflects on itself, looks in the psychological mirror and wonders, I wonder how come that dog is so much bigger than I am and has such a beautiful coat of fur that I don't have, or has such a nice owner.
Though science admits of evolution, it says that random mutations are the chief causative factor behind evolution. It is difficult for me to believe that simply due to random mutations, man has risen from the animal. It is patently obvious to me that there is some intelligent purpose behind the evolution and that some invisible divine presence is guiding the evolution. Why the scientist doesn't see that?
Oh, it's a good question. I'll repeat your question briefly and then answer. According to the scientist, the scientific theory, evolution is taking place simply because of random mutations of the DNA, of the genes, and everything that happens, happens because of some chance, some radiation coming and changing our genes. It's, Ashok says it's very clear and evident to him that this kind of evolution could never have taken place by a roll of the dice, that there must be a consciousness behind it that's guiding it and determining it. And how is it that the scientist doesn't see this? It's a really very good question, which I have wondered about a lot, because it shows the power of superstition. I have myself felt that this question that Ashok asks will be impossible for humanity in the future to understand the answer. Because right now we think we're educated, scientifically minded, rational people. We build rockets to the moon and to Mars. We build computers. We have internets and everything. How could people really believe that all of this has been created by the roll of a cosmic dice, by chance? And there's no rational way of explaining it, except to say that we, as human beings in our evolution, are really not yet rational. If you go and poll the people of the world, all the educated people of the world, in India as well as elsewhere, you'll find 90% believe this. Why? Because what we say, I know that this is true, what we really mean is, that's what everybody else believes. And when we believe in all the earlier periods when we think God created the world or Jesus came to save us, it's not that any of the gods are there to bless us. For the truth of the matter is, very few of us have had the experience and have the direct knowledge. We believe it because other people believe it. Today people believe that the iPhone is the best smartphone to have, and therefore we want it, and that getting job in IT industry or in medicine is the most prestigious occupation for our children, so we want them all to do that, and it's very important to get a job in America or to marry somebody of our caste or whatever. You can have a long list. The truth of the matter is, we hardly know anything ourselves. What we think we know is what we have learned, what the society believes. And what the society believes is not very rational. A famous American author, Mark Twain, about 120 years ago, he wrote a novel called The Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. It's a novel. The Yankee means he's an American. Connecticut was the place he came from, the state of Connecticut. Somehow, by some miracle, he goes back in time 1,000 years to the age in England when King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table were there. And he has the knowledge of a modern American, or a modern American 100 years ago, and he's meeting these people who lived 1,000 years earlier, who have all the beliefs of that time. I'm just giving you one instance. They wonder who he is. They think he's some kind of a magician or a spy or some evil person or something like that. And he wants to prove, there's a famous magician there named Merlin, and he wants to prove that he wants to defend himself. Nobody knows why he's dressed in these strange clothes and talks this strange language and everything. And so he predicts that in another 3 hours, he will blot out the sun, and make the sun disappear. And in 3 hours, suddenly the sun disappears from the skies, and for 1 hour or 2 hours, it's gone. And after that, they think this man is a god and are willing to believe anything he says. Because please bring back the sun. You have taken it away. Please bring it back. In fact, he had an almanac. He had a book which told him that today was the day when the full solar eclipse would be there. And there was nothing he could do about it, but he had the knowledge they didn't have. According to them, the sun going away comes only when the gods are very angry with us and something very horrible is going to happen. According to him, it's simply a prediction of something that's going to happen every so many centuries or decades. So, we are not very different from the people in King Arthur's court. Only thing, instead of believing what Merlin the magician says, we believe what the scientist says, or what the society says, which is really a good example of why we have not reached the end of evolution. We have not really yet become even rational human beings. And Sri Aurobindo says, to be rational is only to be human. Which means today the scientists who think themselves most rational, and most people will say, oh, he's a scientist, he must be very rational and knowledgeable. The scientists are irrational. That doesn't say much for the rest of us who aren't deep scientists. We have our own irrationality. And there's another index. Mother says as long as we act on fear, we are not human. As long as we act on fear. Don't we act on fear all the time? I better take my umbrella because I'm afraid it may rain. I better take this medicine because I'm afraid I'm getting an infection. We act on fear all the time. So on two of the critical measures of being human, according to Mother and Sri Aurobindo, we should be rational and we should be incapable of acting on fear. We should act on knowledge, not on fear. We are not yet even human. And yet Sri Aurobindo says that the human species is destined not just to become rational, not just to... It's the animal that goes on fear. The animal runs because of the fear. He tells us we are not just destined to become rational and bold and courageous, we are destined to go beyond that. We are destined to evolve beyond that. So Ashoka has given us a good argument for why, proof that certainly if the divine created the universe, he could not possibly have thought of the human being as the final stage in perfection. If he could do this much, if he can create all of us and create all of the powers that the human possess, certainly he can do better, he can do more. That seems to be a very rational argument for us. And in fact, we as human beings believe that. What is unique about the human, Sri Aurobindo says, is we are the only species that's unsatisfied with what we are. We're the only species that knows we're capable of error, we're capable of ignorance, we're capable of mistakes, imperfections of all type. No other species wakes up in the morning and says, how can I be a better dog or a better rat or a better bear or a lion? I have killed too many deer this year. I feel guilty about it. I think I should learn to eat plants instead of animals. No animal wakes up and says, how can I be better? The aspiration is really the thing that's most unique about a human being, not our computers and our airplanes and our cell phones and our Nixies and all of those things or our gold change. The thing that's really unique about us is we have an aspiration to be better. We know that we are imperfect and we want life to be more perfect than it is. Up until this life, up until the human level, the evolution has been unconscious. It's not because the animal or the plant says, I want to be better, that it has evolved into something higher. It's nature that wants to create something better because the divine, the Godhead is sleeping in the mineral. The Godhead is dreaming in the plant. The Godhead is waking in the animal. The Godhead is thinking in us. It's in the thinking Godhead, I want to be better. Up until now, it's all been just coming out. The consciousness coming out has created the new forms. That's what Sri Aurobindo says. It's not random radiation and mutation that has created the evolution. It's the hidden Godhead buried in matter, buried in life, that is evolving and creating new forms for its expression. The forms are the instruments for its self-expression. And Chandra is going to tell you a wonderful story later on to this morning about the famous Saint Pusalar, who, to illustrate, really beautifully illustrates this point. It's the consciousness that creates the form and not vice versa. In his book, The Secret of the Vedas, Sri Aurobindo says, in the Vedic hymns, the first god that the rishis call and invoke to the sacrifice is Agni. Agni is the sacrificial fire. But he says, Agni is aspiration. Agni is the human aspiration for the divine. He goes further. He says, not only is Agni the human aspiration for the divine, Agni is the divine aspiration in the human. In other words, our aspiration is the divine in us. It's the divine in us that aspires to come out. It's the divine in us that aspires to realize itself. And that's why aspiration is our highest, it's our first contact with spirit, because it's not we contacting the spirit, it's the spirit in us awakening and saying, I want to come out, I want to discover myself, I want to express myself. And all the Vedic hymns, the most of the hymns have been written to Agni because they knew the human aspiration and the divine will in man is really the secret of the evolution. We are not just imperfect. We are not just aspiring. But we are the only species who has seen beyond ourselves. We know there's something beyond us. We means not all of us have had the highest spiritual experiences and seen Brahman or Overmind or Supermind or all of those. They are Satchidananda. But there's a whole record, especially in this country, of thousands of people, of rishis and yogis and saints over thousands of years, and all over the world those records are there. There is something more. There is a higher reality. There is a higher consciousness. There's something to aspire for. The record is there. So we know there is something beyond us, even if the scientists can't measure it, even if the scientists can't theorize about it, we know it's there. We also know, he tells us, that unlike other species, if you go back hundreds of years, other species, thousands of years, are the same as they were then. I'm not talking about the dogs and horses who have been trained by human beings. But other than that, The cow is the cow. The giraffe is the giraffe. The monkey is the monkey. The flowers are the flowers. They remain what they are. Maybe they adapt a little to living in a dry place or a wet place or a cold place. There are minor adaptations, but they remain what they are. But we already see that the whole history of humanity is that we're constantly changing. We're constantly progressing. We are not the same human species that was here 100 or 500 or 1,000 or 3,000 years ago. It's not just that we have developed technology. It's not just that we have built cities and rocket ships. It's not just that we have a knowledge and a scientific knowledge and all that was not there before. We are different. We have been evolving already. The primitive physical man, he was really, physical consciousness dominated him. That means his one and only concern in life was security. Physical security, survival. How can I get enough to survive? How can I protect myself against the elements or against the other species, other people? How can I... Security and survival was the driving of humanity. But long ago, when human beings learned to cultivate the land, when they learned to defend themselves, when they learned to build fortified cities and other things, they went beyond that. They moved from the physical to the vital. They said, it's not enough we survive. Animals survive. And some of them live a long time. The trees survive. Are we here just to be like that? Just to sit there like a dummy and do nothing? No. We're here to create something. We should have some adventure. We should find out about the world. We should learn. We should enjoy. We should produce. And man ceased to be the physical animal and he became vital. We should learn the joys of interacting with other people. So instead of just producing something, we learn the value of trade. We learn the value of human relationships. We built cities and communities and nations. We became explorers and adventurers and entrepreneurs. No other animal does any of these things. They don't start companies. They don't create empires. They don't wonder what's on the other side of the world or what's on the moon and how can we find out about it. This is all, our species has been evolving from the physical to the vital. And in the last 5 centuries especially, though it started much earlier, we've been going beyond the vital to the mental. We've developed science. It was there 2,000 years ago, but now it's much more. We have developed education. You know, 500 years ago, the definition of a genius, a common definition of a genius is he can read. He can read. Must be a genius. Because nobody, who could read? Before the printing press, which is only 500 years ago, there was nothing to read except what they wrote by hand. How many people? Only the priests or the church scholars could read. Today, we complain, oh, only 90% literacy. 10% people can't read. It's very bad. Somebody can't read. It's very backward. No, we must eliminate it. We must have 100%. Everybody must be able to read. Everybody must go to school. Minimum 15 years, 12 years of education for everybody. It's mostly a law. We have developed not just knowledge. We have developed the idea that our job is not to survive, our job is not just to compete and dominate and conquer one another, that there are ideas that should govern the way we live together. We call them human rights. Every person has rights. There are principles, there are universal ideals. We have a charter of the United Nations of universal rights of all human beings. We recognize there are principles. There are things we should do or shouldn't do according to our ideas. We think. We don't just do what's convenient to us. We don't just do what's comfortable for us. We don't just do what's pleasing. So there has been an evolution from the physical level to the vital level to the physical, to the mental level in human beings. Our own evolution has moved through these stages. We are the only species who's not the same now as it was in the past. We're already evolving. But our evolution up until now has been within the type of humanity. It's like we're now a drought-resistant, high-yielding variety of human being, with multiple colors. Our roses are not just red. We come in all different colors today. And we have more capabilities than human beings of the past. But essentially, we're still human. This is a mental evolution. We've gone from a physical evolution to a vital evolution to a mental evolution. But he's talking about a spiritual evolution. It's not the same thing. So we know that human beings can improve. We didn't need Life Divine to tell us that. We know that we're living longer today than we have ever lived in the past. The scientists will tell us we can improve. We know how to do our genes to eliminate diseases, to make us stronger and healthier by our diet. There are researchers that are trying to extend the human life for another 100 or 200 years, and science may achieve that. But that's not the evolution he's talking about, and that's not the immortality that the Vedic rishis sought and aspired for. He's talking about not a mental evolution, not that we become just perfectly rational human beings, and he makes it clear, if we become perfectly rational human beings, we won't cease to make errors. We won't cease to have problems. We won't cease to have unhappiness. We won't cease to be imperfect, because mind itself is an instrument of ignorance. Mind itself is an instrument that the ego's using. We'll have bigger weapons than we have now. We'll have more technology than we have now, and the technology can help us destabilize the climate of the planet or create problems on other planets. But it will not solve the problems of our imperfection, because the human is an imperfect species. We are a transitional species. We are not the purpose of the evolution. The evolution has to go further. So he says, survival is not enough for the human. We are not content with just surviving, and even if we get 3 meals a day. We want to grow. We want to expand. We want to have more. We want to have a bigger house. We want to have a variety of different foods. We want to go and see different places. We want to have different clothes for every day of the week, and so forth and so on. We want growth. But growth is not enough for the human being. Our vitality may be content with growing. Yes, yes, now I have 4 cars. Is it enough? Well, maybe we'll have one more. I've been 17 times on holidays to all of the countries, but anyway, this year we'll go to someplace else, someplace new. We want to grow. The vital wants to expand endlessly. And there were Maharajas who had 100 cars. In fact, I think the Raja here in Madras, he had more than 100 cars. It's a big problem when you have 100 cars. First of all, where to store them, and how to keep them in repair, and how to wash them and keep them clean. You need a lot of people just to maintain the 100 cars, and then the problem is people keep coming and wanting to borrow them. And how can you say, I don't have a car, my car is busy, or something like that, when you've got 50 of them sitting there in the parking lot? So it's a bother, but that's our urge. Our vital urge is we want more. We can never have enough. And that urge is spreading all over the world, and we're consuming more and more and buying more and more until we have no room for everything that we bought, so we need bigger houses in order to store everything we bought. And when the cities are getting crowded, we move and create cities elsewhere so that we can have more and more, but that's growth. That's not what the human being is about. We also develop. We also seek something called development means we want to be better. We not just want to be more, we want to be better. So we want our children to be more educated than we are. We want the future people to be more cultured. We want to develop a civilization, we want to develop a culture, we want to develop better manners, we want to develop more knowledge. We want to develop a better governing society with greater rights for people, greater justice for people. We want to get rid of this nasty corruption and especially this nasty pollution, which is going everywhere. We don't want just more of the same. We want something better. We want development. But that's not the evolution he's talking about. That's not the evolution that we should be seeking when we wake up in the morning. And that raises the question, of course, is what are we praying for? What are we asking Mother for? We have come to Mother. We are a rare few who have come to Mother. No, Mother, she's accepted us. She answers our prayers. What are we doing with that? What are we asking for? Mother, can I have more? Can I have more growth? Or on our better days, we say, no, Mother, I have enough of this, but can we be better? Can we get something higher? Can we get something better? I want to, not just growth. I'm not like that. I'm not just satisfied with what I have. I'm not just trying for security. I'm not just asking for growth. I want to develop. I want my children to have more education. I want them to, so many things. But that, he says, is not what they have come for and not what the divine has come for. They want evolution. They want our species to evolve. They are here not just for the human species to evolve, for our soul's evolution. That's what our soul has come for. Our soul did not come to get more of everything. Our soul did not come to seek comfort. Our soul did not come to be famous or popular or have more prestige like Lady Catherine or get more knowledge and higher grades in school or earn more money or live in a more modern society. Our soul came for its evolution. Having reached all the way to the human level, having started as the mineral and the plant and the animal, and we have gone all the way up the scale, after all of this, after having come so far, if you climb to the top of Mount Everest and then you ask, is there any bananas here? Is that why you climbed all the way to the top of Mount Everest, risking your life just for a banana? If you get to the moon and you say, the TV is not working, is that why you went to the moon or to Mars? Why are we here? Why have we come here? What do we want? He says the aspiration in us, our soul, our human aspiration, the divine aspiration in us is for evolution. So it raises the question, what is evolution? If it's not survival, if it's not just comfort and security, if it's not just growth and getting more, if it's not just developing and getting what other people have done, and India should become like America, or whatever it is, what is it then? What is this evolution that we should be aspiring for and seeking? By evolution, he says, it's a change of consciousness. It's a change of consciousness. It's not just to get higher marks and know more than other people or be able to speak better or anything else. It's a fundamental change in consciousness, he says. We are evolving from the mental to to the supramental. He says it's spiritual evolution, but spiritual evolution is nothing new. The plant has been evolving spiritually. The animal has evolved spiritually, meaning it's the spirit that has evolved from the mineral to the plant. It's the spirit that's evolved from the plant to the animal. It's the spirit that's evolved from the animal to the human. So spirit, they're all spiritual evolution. The evolution we are here for is the supramental evolution, meaning we have to go beyond the mind. We may not be rational yet, but it doesn't matter. You know, in South America, Appa has often mentioned, there's a place where in one generation they were all traveling by llama, which is kind of a camel, a mountain camel, not exactly similar to a camel. In the next generation, they're flying by airplane. It doesn't mean that we have to go through the trains and the bullock cart and the trains and the cars and the airplanes to get to the airplanes or the rockets. We can jump. So even if we're not yet fully rational, he says don't waste time, because the rational people are not very rational and they're creating more problems. Let's go as quickly as possible to the supramental. That's what they came to bring. He says there's something else that distinguishes evolution from development. We know what growth is, get more, it's quantitative. We know what development is, it's you do something in a better way, in a higher way. We get more organized. When we're more organized, we develop. We try to organize the traffic in Madras. We try to organize the communication networks, make everything more efficient and improved. But by evolution, we mean something else. Evolution means a reversal. You know that phrase he keeps coming back to? A reversal of consciousness. When we evolve, how do I know whether I'm evolving or growing or progressing? Evolution means there's always a reversal of consciousness. What is that reversal? What is the reversal we should be seeking? How do we know when there's a reversal? Any idea? What is reversal of consciousness? Change in attitude. Change in attitude may not be a reversal. It can be. Huh? Past consecration, huh? Past consecration is a method. What is consecration? Transformation. What is transformation? If we don't know what reversal is, or what is transformation? How are we going to transform ourselves if we don't know what it is? How are we going to evolve if we don't know what evolution means? If I wake up in the morning and say, okay, yesterday I developed, the day before I was growing, before that I was getting more comfortable and secure. Today, Mother, I want to be transformed. What is it? How will we know when we do it? How do we know what to ask for? How do we know what to try? Life response. Life response. Consciousness, huh? Education mind is education. Life response is not evolution. Life response can be come as a result of an evolutionary change. It can come as a result at many levels. To be one with the divine is a great spiritual realization. Certainly when we do that, we have made an evolutionary progress, sure. But that's one step. One high step in it. But we have to start from where we are. What is that human consciousness? What characterizes that human consciousness? You said when man sees the world in a unified manner, when he sees not from the mind but from the intuition. Instead of seeing the dualities, correct. Correct. What is it that sees the dualities? Huh?
I suppose that is his mind seeing.
we have a chapter on what is it that sees the dualities? Ego and the dualities. As long as we are in ego, we see everything in dualities. This is good, that's bad. The definition of good is what Lizzie says, Wickham is a good man because he's very nice to me, he likes me, he's very charming and he pleases me. He's good. Darcy doesn't like me, he looks down on me, therefore he's bad, he's evil. Dualities exist because the human consciousness lives in the ego. Evolution for us means reversal of consciousness. How do we turn the ego inside out? How do we reverse the ego? What do we do when we're in the ego? How do we reverse it? What is the ego? Why is it the cause of our problems? What is ego? Ego tells us, I'm separate from everybody else. Not only that, ego tells me, I want to be better than everybody else. Ego tells me, if somebody else has a problem, if somebody else loses something, then that means I'm a little richer by comparison, no? Because before he had more than me, now I have more than him, so I'm richer than he is. That's ego. Ego looks at everybody else as competition. Ego wants to be better, like Mrs. Bennett wants to dominate over Lady Lucas, and Lady Catherine wants everybody to come to the court and listen to her. Speaking all nonsense, that's ego. And Darcy wants to come to a dance, so he doesn't dance, but he looks at everybody and says, I won't dance, I'm superior to all of you. That's ego. The fundamental nature of ego is we feel separate from everybody else. How are we going to reverse that? First step in evolution, how are we going to reverse that? What is the reversal when we come out of ego? We have to discover the psychic. Now you see the problem Sherbino has, because until we know what evolution is, it's not likely that we're going to evolve, no? We know what growth is. I think we can all honestly say we know what growth is. We all have a pretty good idea what growth is and even development is, and we want it. But how often when we wake up in the morning do we say, how am I going to come out of ego and get to my psychic? How am I going to reverse my consciousness? Is that really what we want? No, I'm right and everybody should listen to me. I'm the mother-in-law and therefore my daughter-in-law should do what I say. I'm the man in the family, so my wife should obey me. I'm the boss, so my employees should subordinate. Our whole life is we live in the ego and want to affirm our ego. And Mother says, we not only want our ego to be better, but the truth of the matter is the perversity of human consciousness. We feel better when everybody else is worse off. Oh, there was a flood and you had problems in the flood. I'm very sorry to hear it. I didn't have any problems. Somehow, how does the fact that somebody else had problems and I didn't make me better? I may be happy I didn't have problems, but somehow I feel special. See, all these people suffered and I didn't suffer. So I got something more. I didn't get anything. They lost something, but the ego. We can take that perverse, and ego is universal, pervasive. It's as common among human beings as one nose and two eyes and two ears. To say, no, I've got over the ego, I'm not like that, I'm a mother's devotee. It's as much as saying I don't have eyes and ears and nose anymore. Or there's no heart inside or there's no head inside. I've gone to supermind, no brain there anymore. That is the nature of the human consciousness, and the only way to get out of ego is to evolve, and the only way to get evolved is we have to go from the ego to the psychic. What does the psychic tell us? Not, I'm better than everybody else, or I must dominate over everybody else. Everybody else is a part of me. Everybody, we are all one. My happiness comes from the happiness of everybody else. My prosperity comes from the prosperity of everybody else. The joy I get is not when everybody comes and gives to me. The joy comes when I can give, when I have something to give that's valuable to everybody else, when my joy can spread to everybody else. So I must, if I want to wake up with an aspiration for evolution, it should be an aspiration. How many people can I make happy today? How many people, not how popular can I be and how many people can compliment me on my sari or on my speech or anything else? How many people can I help prosper today? It's not so easy to make that reversal. Appa says, when we pray to Mother, we're all praying to Mother for so many things. He said, actually, when we pray to Mother, we're praying to Mother to make our ego better, to make our ego stronger. Say, Mother, solve my problem for me. Mother, make me more successful. Mother, I need money for the house. I need this and all. Meaning, Mother, please make my ego more successful. Mother has come for spiritual transformation, for supramental transformation, and we want Mother to organize and increase the strength of our ego. Oh, Mother's grace is there. I've become so popular. Meaning my ego is expanding. So Appa says the first thing we should do is not call Mother, because when we call Mother, ego gets stronger. The first thing we should do before we call Mother is, we should first say, Mother, thy will, not my will. Mother, I want to be what you want me to be. I'm not asking you to give me what I want. I want to become what you want me to be. Mother, help me come out of the ego. Not how can I dominate over my mother-in-law or my daughter-in-law or my husband or my wife or my boss or my subordinate. How can I discover my soul? What progress can I make today that will really make me shift from the ego, a reversal of consciousness, instead of looking at everything from my point of view, and everybody should appreciate my point of view. I'm right. I'm right. I won the argument. Finally, I convinced him. After all this time, I convinced him that I was right. That's our failure. When everybody, we convince that we are right, we have failed. We've only aggrandized our ego. How can we discover that everybody around us is right? That everybody who opposes us and criticizes us and complains about us is right? Then we are making a progress. We're moving from the ego to the psychic. And then life responds instantly. And at that moment, it responds not to our prayer, it responds to our reversal. And it responds magnificently to the sincerity of that reversal. So, evolution means a reversal of consciousness, and the first step in that evolution is to move from the ego to the psychic. And we all know the characteristics of the psychic. The psychic is joy. The psychic is pure goodwill. The psychic is pure self-giving. The first person, when after I met Appa some 44 years ago, the first person he ever said that person has the psychic coming to the surface was a servant, emaciated servant. She hardly ate anything. Her name was Raji, who used to love serving people. Everybody loves to be served by Raji. If they come to the house, immediately they'll say, where's Raji? If she sees somebody come to the house, oh, that man, when he comes, he always wants a glass of water. Before he can ask, she will give the water. She was a terrible cook. Appa said she couldn't cook anything, but everybody said Raji's a wonderful cook. Because whatever she served, it tasted sweet. It tasted sweet not because the food was delicious, but because her joy in giving. She had the psychic touch. in whatever she gave. So psychic doesn't mean wealth. She didn't have enough money for three meals a day. Psychic doesn't mean high education. It doesn't mean living in a big house. It doesn't mean any of those things. It means getting from the ego to the psychic. That reversal means we know how to see all the world around us as an expression of what we are inside. No? We want all the world around us to be what we want it to be. That's the ego. But the psychic is to see that everything that's a problem in the world has a reflection in us. How can I change? How can I be different than I am? How can I have the aspiration to be different than I am? We know what responsibility is. Mr. Bennett decides to take responsibility after being irresponsible for 25 years. It's not spiritual evolution. It's just to be a man. We can say it's mental. He becomes mental instead of vital. He says, I must be conscious for what I'm doing. But Darcy is a little different. Because Darcy says, he goes and says, Wickham's elopement with Lydia is my fault. My responsibility. He doesn't take, what is his responsibility? Wickham is not his relative and Lydia is not his daughter. He's not responsible. He takes consciousness responsibility. He takes consciousness responsibility for what's happened to everybody around him at the end of the story and decides to do something that will help everybody. That's a reversal of consciousness. That's movement from the ego looking from his point of view. From Mr. Bennett's point of view as a father, he does have a responsibility for his daughter. And he has been irresponsible. It's correct. It's mental. But when Darcy says, there's a problem around me, other people are making mistakes, I'm responsible for curing them, that's a spiritual attitude. That's a psychic attitude. So moving from responsibility or irresponsibility to consciousness responsibility, instead of blaming other people, oh yes, you did something wrong and now you're suffering for it. If you are suffering for something, there must be something I can do. There must be some responsibility on my part. There must be some inner count. That's reversal of consciousness. That's evolution. He says the idea that there can be a spiritual perfection on life. It's not a crazy idea. Humanity from its earliest times, chapter 1, the human aspiration, he says the earliest formula, God, light, freedom, is promises to be the last. He says the idea of a kingdom of God on earth has been there as a dream and aspiration of humanity for thousands of years. Our aspiration to be better, our aspiration to have more, our aspiration for a life of perfection, our aspiration for a life of joy is not an illusion. It is really what we're here for. It's not a vague dream, oh, I'm already got enough, I'm happy, I shouldn't be greedy, I shouldn't ask for too much. No. The soul should ask for everything, but should ask for everything for everybody. Should ask for everything that Mother wants, that everything the Divine wants to manifest, not everything that I want for my aggrandizement or my self-importance. We have so much to ask for. We have so much to ask for. Mother, I can ask myself every day to be more perfect, to be better, to be more human, to be more spiritual. Mother has a wonderful prayer, prayer for those who wish to serve the divine. Appa wrote about it 45 years ago. He wrote each line of it. He says, glory to thee, O Lord, who conquers over every obstacle. And the second line is wonderful. Grant that nothing in me should be an obstacle to thy work. Grant that, what is thy work? Thy work is the supramental evolution on earth. Nothing in me should be an obstacle to the work. Meaning, my prayer every morning should be, how can I move from the ego to the psychic? How can I move from selfishness to self-giving? How can I move from falsehood to truth? How can I move from competitions to really goodwill and goodness towards others? That's what we're here for. That's not what Mother is asking of us. That's what our souls are here for. That's why we have come. Why else should we come to Mother? If we have gone somewhere, it may be because we want to develop our egos. We have come to Mother and Sri Aurobindo. They are the only ones, maybe in the history, who have really come to deliver the message of why we're here and what's the future purpose of the whole universe and why the Divine has created the universe and why we have gone through these births. So we've come here because something in us really wants the supramental evolution. Otherwise, we would have gone somewhere else. We would have gone to a God who promises more saris or more gold or more import fame or power or something else. Something in us really wants what Mother wants for us. That's supramental evolution.